Welcome to Baiterson. We make up stories improvised and recorded live. We start each story by choosing a random phrase from a source of text. My name is Ben, and my source is Committed to Memory, 100 Best Poems to Memorize, edited by John Hollander.
My name is Casey, and my source is My Friend Dahmer, a graphic novel by Durf Backdurf.
My name is Mike, and my source is Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II by William Blum.
My name is Drew, and my source is Middlemarch by George Eliot.
We will now choose a performer at random, and that performer is...
Drew, that's me. All right, I am flipping to a random page in Middlemarch by George Eliot. And then, laying a plan to spoil all by making her forfeit her property. That prompt again. And then laying a plan to spoil it all, to spoil all by making her forfeit her property.
Elizabeth's favorite possession in the world was a giant brass tuba. It had been handed down to her by her grandfather, and she carried it wherever she went. She carried it all through elementary school. She carried it all through middle school. And now, as she was finally ending her high school career, she was still carrying it to this
day. She wanted to bring it on stage for graduation. And by this time, everyone in the school district was accustomed to Elizabeth having her tuba with her. But there was a new superintendent who refused to let her do it. His name was Mr. Dilby.
And Mr. Dilby came in on kind of a law and order platform. That was what he emphasized during his campaign to get elected by the trustees.
No shirts with lettering of any kind. Only geometric shapes. If you're going to have something on your shirt, it has had to be a geometric shape.
And if you were tardy at all,
you mowed the lawn.
You mowed the lawn. You got detention, and you were suspended for a day. Playground. He made kids do like marching formations during recess. He made sports mandatory. He insisted that everyone be organized alphabetically in their lockers. He just had a whole huge program, and he would be GD'd if somebody was going to come on stage during graduation wearing anything other than a regulation gown and cap.
His argument also consisted of the point that her name was Elizabeth, right?
Yeah.
Elizabeth had never actually learned to play the tuba. And despite carrying it around this entire time, it was sort of an intense commitment she never quite felt ready to make. She felt like maybe she wouldn't be as good as she wanted. Maybe her grandfather, I believe it was, wouldn't be proud posthumously. And she, as a result, never took any lessons. She was a little bit ashamed of that. And she didn't pretend that she could play it. But Mr. Dilby had a point. Like, this is just costume, basically.
Dilby had actually made a miscalculation because he did try to be nice. He sort of knew what it looked like to be nice. And when he was talking to Elizabeth about preventing her from going on stage, he said, look, maybe it'd be one thing if you played the tuba, but everybody knows you don't even play the tuba. So I just can't let you carry this thing on stage when you don't even know how to play the tuba. He said it three times.
And Elizabeth said to herself, I'll damn well learn to play the tuba, and I'm going to walk on stage with that tuba if that's the best you got, Mr. Dilby.
So the ceremony was on Saturday. The Friday before, she went to his office. He had an office in the high school, the superintendent did, so he's filling out papers and listening to a police blotter. and then he hears some coming from down the hallway.
And his first thought is, what is this unauthorized? Somebody's got a boombox and they're walking the hallways playing some kind of polka or big band or something. And I have not signed off on any public music permits. I know that.
So he pulls on his gloves, which he always pulls on when he's going to lay down the law. These clinical, like those disposable latex gloves. He just like pulls them on and he goes out into the hallway because he really likes the authority of like stretching them on because they're so hard to get and just looks like someone who really means business. And so he's walking in, stuffing his hands through this elastic, and then he sees it's Elizabeth and he stops in mid glove and she's just marching back and forth in the hallway, blowing her tuba. And then, He yells at her to stop. And then she does and says, "So I guess I can graduate with the tuba, huh?"
And Dilby almost, his impulse is to push Elizabeth up against the wall. He has this violent impulse. And that's part of his reason for being here in Tronville is that he got fired from his last job for physically assaulting a student, and he had to pay some people on the dark web for a new social security number and create a new identity and create a whole fake job history so that he could get this job, this new superintendent job, because his old name, which was Mr. Trent Skidisky, was all over the news. If anybody had searched Trent Skidisky, they would have seen what happened in the Riverside School District.
And they also would have seen a storied career as a professional tuba player, which is something that he never had revealed to Elizabeth and never would reveal to Elizabeth, he thought. But now in this confrontation, he sees her just butchering the tuba, just absolutely, her embouchure is trash. She has no idea what she's doing. She's basically making farting sounds.
So he checks his impulse. He checks his impulse to physically attack her, but he can't check his impulse to show her how to play the tuba, how a real person plays a tuba.
But he rips it out of her arms and thrusts his lips against the
mouthpiece,
and just it does like tears into a full-length version of Inagata De Vida. And he is totally into it. This is not the disciplinarian anyone had seen before. He he's got his feet wide apart like James Hetfield from Metallica, and he's actually dancing, and he kicks and dents a locker. And this crowd forms around him and watches the whole 17-minute spectacle. And then he finally finishes and he hands her the tuba back and says, "That's how you play that thing. Don't come back. Don't graduate until you can do that." And then he rips his gloves off and throws them on the ground, which he always does. There's gloves all over the school. The janitor got tired of picking them up because it's, you know, multiple times a day. And he goes back into his office and slams the door.
Crowd that's gathered is astounded. They're whispering to each other. But Elizabeth is just dejected. She hangs her head. She kind of slinks backward, trying to be as inconspicuous as possible with this giant tuba as she like tries to wedge like her way through the door. And as she's doing it, it clangs and everybody turns and looks at her and kind of like shakes their head a little bit and then goes back to saying like, "Wasn't that awesome?" Like
she doesn't put the tuba back on. It's the first time that anyone has seen her without the tuba for years. And she shows up back at home without the tuba on, and her parents
Holding it, right? She doesn't have her head through the
called? And they're speechless. They don't know what to say. They don't say anything to her. She goes to her room, puts the tuba in the closet, goes to graduation on Saturday in her gown and cap, walks, graduates with no tuba. Dilby won't look her in the eye. She is completely crestfallen. Her spirit's broken. She decides she's supposed to go to East Side Community College to get her associate's degree, and then she was planning to transfer over to State.
But she just drops out, and she starts working at the Wendy's. She's working late nights, and she kind of hates her job. She doesn't really like the people who work there, except for this one guy, Brent, who's kind of nice. He's a fry cook, and you know, they
and
talk.
He's always, the fun thing about Brent is that he's just unaffected by her negative mood. He always, he doesn't pretend like it's not happening, but he's not going to go there. You know, he says, "Hey, Elizabeth, how's it going? Boy, you look sad again today. What's going on? You want to talk about it? Let's have a seat. Let's have some fries. What are you doing after work?" He's just relentlessly cheery, and he's not giving up on Elizabeth.
And she likes it, even though she kind of powers through in this negative energy space. Inside, it cheers her up a little bit. And, you know, after about 6 months working there, he rubs off on her, and she starts to kind of think about, like, yeah, what am I doing, like, here? What, you know, where did I go wrong? Like, maybe I should have gone to community college.
And she says, you know, that's, what am I doing here? But she actually does sit down with Brent and have some fries after work one day. And she says, Brent, what, I've been so in this myopic state for the last 6 months that I've worked here. What are you doing here? What's your story? How did you end up here? And he says, well, I actually graduated from Riverside before I came over here, but things just, and this is the first time Elizabeth has ever seen Brent get down sort of at all, kind of some clouds come over him. He gets a little dark and he just says, and yeah, I graduated from Riverside, but I just, I just need a change of scene. So I moved here after I graduated. And he doesn't say anything else. Oh, quite uncharacteristic for Brent. He kind of gets quiet. And they both sit there in silence for a minute.
And she says, well, thanks for sharing. Sorry that I feel like I haven't been as sort of an equal part of the friendship, I'm going to make an effort from now on. And he jumped right back to being positive and said, don't worry about it, blah, blah, blah. Never noticed anything like that. And she went home and couldn't sleep that night. And she heard and she felt like it was because she wasn't alone. She kept getting out of bed and feeling, you know, something's, you know, like the drawers are closed. Okay, like there was this weird itchy feeling. And then finally, when she got back into bed, the ghost of her grandfather was sitting on the pillow next to the one that she was lying on. And she was like, oh my God, granddad. And he was like, hey, geez, that was hard to do. But I'm here now.
Have a lot of time. I don't know exactly how this works, but it's like, it's limited. It's infrequent. So I'm going to cut to the chase.
And she's like, granddad, I'm so glad you're here. He's like, I don't have time. This friendship.
She's like, you look great. You look great. Where are you? He's like, shh, look, just stop. Stop. I got to get through this because I really don't know how long this is going to take.
Your friend is hurt and your enemy is the reason. And she said, what? She said, what?
And he disappears. He just flashes out of existence right after that. And she's just like, what does that mean?
But she knew it was Brent. She knew he meant Brent with just a little bit of reflection and started thinking about how to reach out more to Brent, how to learn more. And sure enough, the next time the rush had finished and the fries were already fried and she was done wiping down the counter, she struck up a little idle conversation with Brent and just said, what exactly drove you to leave, what was the name of the university?
Riverside.
And he's like, I don't really want to talk about it. And she has this moment of awareness where she's kind of like, oh, I've been so kind of wrapped up in my thing. And he was really vulnerable to me. I guess, you know, I've never talked about this, what really put me in the state that he's so used to. And so she says, oh, okay, look, and they go and they sit down. She's like,
this is her granddad was always doing this too, was like, was never telling, never, asking people what he was always sensing that, like, he was always telling about himself, like, you know, sometimes, or this happened to me and that made me feel really bland. And then, it was like she and her cousins, like he could always make them feel safe that way.
Yeah, by kind of showing some solidarity and some sameness. So she said, you know, I know you've been dealing with me being in a sour mood for 6 months, and I really appreciate you hanging in there and continue to try. And she tells him the story about what led to her depression and this downturn in her life. And Brent is just speechless.
The whole time she's telling the story, Brent's just kind of paying attention, like not too big of a deal. But when she gets to the part about the tuba and the throwdown in the hallway, Brent kind of goes a little pale. And she finishes the story, and Brent kind of looks at the floor and kind of plays with the fry basket for a minute idly, and then says, what'd you say his name was? And she says, Mr. Dilby.
And he's like, yeah, that's so weird.
That's just funny, because everything you said about him, down to the rubber gloves, sounds exactly like Mr.
Trubilsky.
Good old Mr. Trubilsky, who actually is why I left Riverside.
And he goes on to tell Elizabeth about how he was on the flag team, and every morning there was this very regimented routine at Riverside where the flag team would get the flag out of its special box, and they would walk in order, and it would unfold it. They'd unfold it in this ritualistic way and hook it up to the flagpole. And Brent had let a corner of the flag touch the grass on the flag team, and Trubilsky lost it on him, actually wrapped the flagpole rope around Brent's ankle and hoisted Brent up the flagpole and left him there. He was planning to leave him there all day. Some other teachers called the police, so after an hour or two, the fire department came and got him down. But that was, in fact, the incident that led to Trubilsky being fired, having legal charges set against him, and then fleeing to Mexico to start his life over again and create his fake identity before moving back.
And Trubilsky, known as, he directed the band at the school and was a consummate tuba player and musician in general. It was sort of this weird other side of his personality. People who only knew him through the music really kind of liked him. He was sort of a minor celebrity in the school, but anybody that interfaced with him directly knew what a tyrant he was and had stories of rubber gloves and abuse. And after it had all gone down, Brent was just too shaken and dropped out and started his life at Wendy's. And they both stared at each other with this understanding that this had to be the same guy. This had to be their connection, and what a thing for them to both end up at
and then,
Wendy's.
And Elizabeth heard a little tapping on the window. Brent didn't turn his head. He didn't seem to hear it, but she turned, and her granddad was out there, and he was pointing to Brentman and put both his thumbs up and was mouthing.
Elizabeth was gesturing like, oh, you should come in. And he was like, no,
pointed to his wrist and he poofed away.
Now, Elizabeth's neighbor, Kimbrelia, was her best,
yep,
her closest friend.
Was her next door neighbor.
Her next door neighbor. Her name was Kimbrelia.
There she was.
Lived next door. And she was a pretty good friend of, she had been a really good friend,
right,
of Elizabeth's.
When you grow up together, you play together, you're friends with who's around, and they got older and drifted apart, but still they've got that history, right?
When one of you goes to community college and the other one goes and works at Wendy's, you just don't interact that much anymore.
But Kimbrelia,
when one of you carries a tuba around at school for
years at a time,
yeah, like, and you want to, you know, go to parties and be normal, you drift apart.
Kimbrelia had always, though, one of the things when they were younger that they had always been, they were schemers together. They were always getting into trouble. They were always spying on people. They were pranking people, coming up with plots to sneak around and do stuff in the neighborhood and to their families.
In Kimbrelia's keepsake box, she still had an invisible ink pen that had a infrared, like, cap. You push a button, you can read the ink, and two walkie-talkies that she and Elizabeth used to use all the time.
Kimbrelia had a guitar, an old electric guitar that had a broken jack and only a couple old rusty strings. And when they were roughly like in middle school, she they had planned to start a band together, and they'd come up with a name of the band and choreograph some dance moves, but neither of them knew how to play their instruments. It was the
Deadeye.
Deadeye was the name. And
that was a quiz.
They'd made up part of one song, just the words. That was like, coming through, gonna get you, it's too hot. And then they do a little dance break.
And so Cambrellier was shocked when there was a knock on her door one day, and she kind of like looked out the window because she didn't like to answer her door. She didn't know who it was. And there was Elizabeth, years older, but
no still tuba.
No tuba. And
some dude who she'd never seen.
So Kimbrella opened the door, and the first thing she said was like, "Hey, I haven't seen you in a while. What happened to your tuba?" And Elizabeth said, "It's a long story, but look, I really need your help. This is my friend Brent. I wondered if we could come in, have some tea.
We have a mission.
We have." And that was like, and that was the thing they used to say to each other. Like, that was their code word for like, oh, we're let's go into prank mode.
It was not Kimbrellia, too coded, to be honest.
And Kimbrellia,
and when they were kids, they felt like they called it a code, but
nobody
they were
knew,
pretty much
nobody
just
knew
saying what they were
about.
Doing.
Yeah, they would say it loud too, as if nobody could understand it, and all the parents would be like, oh, geez.
They'd
like,
give this big wink. Yeah.
And Kimbrellia says, well, my parents are actually home, so maybe it's not safe to talk in here, so maybe we should... She clicked and winked and
go to the crow's nest.
Yeah, and so they went out, and they actually, all three of them, climbed up into the treehouse where they had schemed so many of their plans before. And Elizabeth broke it all down and told her the whole story and said,
we got to go to Dilby's house and find some evidence that he is Trinkledong. And Brent corrected her on the actual name, but the girls didn't care. but we can't do it without you. So we're going to need some invisible ink, and we're going to need some walkie-talkies. I wish I had mine from when I was a kid. And Kimbrellia said, I'll stop you right there. And then she went to her room and brought him back to the treehouse and brought an extension cord and a charger and took the batteries out of the walkie-talkies and charged them. Said, it's going to take a little while. We can't. Hope you weren't trying to do this tonight. And
Elizabeth said, no, the important thing is that we do this right. So if it's going to take a little bit of time, then so be it. And Brent says,
I'm not sure. I didn't understand that we were going to like be breaking into his house or something. Like what did you have in mind? He was just sort of stunned a little bit by Elizabeth's, brash plan. And, Elizabeth sensed his hesitation and she
laid it all out. She said like, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to put a note in invisible ink. We're going to put it on his door. He's going to get it. We're going to put it in an envelope. So it's like a letter. He's going to get the letter. He's going to open it. He's going to see that it's just blank paper. He's going to wonder about that for a little while. While he's wondering, we're going to be getting into position. Eventually, he's going to figure out that it's invisible ink, because who wouldn't, right? And then he's going to read on the paper our note to him, which is going to say, we know who you are. If you move from this position, you will be exposed. You know, of course, he's a psycho, so he's not going to do that. And this is where Brent cut in and said, like, I think you don't understand. I think he actually is a dangerous man. Like, this is a dangerous plan. We can't, you know, and Elizabeth is like, well, no. We'll have the walkie-talkies, so we'll be safe.
Brent just keeps coming back with,
shouldn't we just call the police? I mean,
maybe we can just, yeah, call the police, and there might be just enough evidence on the internet, or if we raise a suspicion, people could look into it. And
Elizabeth says, no. Kimbrellia has a record, so we cannot call the police. Like, if we call the police, she's out.
She actually has a warrant. She has a warrant out for her arrest. And we can't get the cops involved.
And none of this was true, but Kimbrellia sensed that Elizabeth was desperate to convince Brent, so she didn't intervene, because above all, she and Elizabeth were on the same team.
Brent, and they were both back. They were fully back in the mode where they would do and say anything to pull off a scheme. They didn't care. They would tell any lie. They would do break any rule. They didn't mind. And they were in that space times 10 because it had been a lot of years before they felt this. And they were intoxicated by scheming and planning and pulling off a special plan.
And Elizabeth got Brent with this. She said, "Brent, he is a dangerous man. We know that firsthand because he hurt us. He took something from us, and he's not going to change until we hurt him." And that got him.
Brent it gravely
disturbed him,
nodded.
But he couldn't argue with it.
He nodded gravely, and they started to make their way down out of the treehouse and decided to break for the night, let the batteries charge. Maybe refine the invisible ink plan a little bit. They were going to sleep on it and went back to their respective houses to sleep. And
Elizabeth's just about to go to sleep, and all of a sudden she hears a noise in the closet, and her grandpa's ghost comes scrambling out behind the clothes. "Oh, thank God you're here. I came here 3 or 4 other times, but you weren't here, and I bounced around. I couldn't find you, but I ran out of time each time. Okay, listen. I got word about what your plan is, and I'm a little concerned because I think," and he disappeared.
She goes, "That's all right, Grandpa. I'll take it from here. Don't worry, buddy." And she lights a little candle for him, and with a little note in invisible ink that says, "Love you, Grandpa. Don't worry, we got this," and goes to sleep. And next morning, bright and early, goes to her Wendy's shift. And she's on the breakfast shift, and while she is working there, a familiar gentleman walks into the Wendy's, and she recognizes him easily as Mr. Trinkenblom.
Whom she knows Dilby.
Who she knows is Mr. Dilby. And she sees him before he sees her, and she kind of gasps and ducks back into the fry cook area, and it's like, Brent! But Brent's
don't go out there. Don't go out there. But there's not a lot of other people on. Like, Sarah's on her break, and you know, Melissa's the manager, so she hates to come out to the counter. So Mr. Trilby just kind of walks up to the counter, and there's no employees, and he like leans back and like looks around, and they're like pressed against the fry cooker, just like sweating buckets like into their shirts.
And Dilby starts like slapping on the counter. He is agitated. You know, this should be a well-run place. The door is unlocked. The lights are on. Workers should be there. And he starts hollering. So the Elizabeth and Brent have no choice. They pull their visors down really low, and they both walk out like looking down at their shoes. And she comes up and tries to use a voice and is like, "Good morning, morning. Wendy's may I take your order?" And he's like, "Look me in the eye, child.
Straighten up, straighten up."
Elizabeth looks
be
up
proud
at
of
him
yourself.
And he says, "Oh, well, hi there. Elizabeth, was it? How's the tuba going?"
Ooh.
And she just boils with rage, but grits her teeth and is like, "Fine, what would you like for breakfast?" And he says, gosh, I don't know. There's so many great options on the menu." And he just starts deliberately taking his time and really sort of torturing her with his
asking
process.
Her for a recommendation and how everything is made.
Do you know if the French fries are gluten-free?
The nutritional profile is of the different things. Testing her on everything that she's supposed to know
she's
as an employee.
She's quivering with anger, but she takes his order eventually and takes his money, and then he kind of smirks and goes and sits down. And then Brent, meanwhile, is in the back, like spitting into his French fries. And
Dilby ordered a coffee. And like at coffee shops, they'd started doing this thing where they write the name of the person who ordered the coffee. And so she writes Mr. Dilby on the coffee thing, and he eats his meal and takes his coffee and leaves and heads out. And they decide they're so mad that when they get off their shift, they go to Kimbelia's house and they say, okay, tonight's the night. We're gonna do this. And so they decide, the final parts of the plan is that they're gonna write the letter that says that they know that Dilby is Trabelsky. They know about the Riverside situation, and if he leaves his house, they're going to
expose him.
And
what, if he has to stay in his house for the rest of his life, or else they'll expose him.
That's what they're trying to sort out. They want to paralyze him there because they want him to feel fear. And then they decide they're just going to freestyle, depending on what he does. If he is at all repentant. Oh, and this is the other part of the plan.
They're going to call.
They send a walkie-talkie in with the note. And they're going to leave the walkie-talkie in there. And that's how they're going to communicate with him. And basically, they want him to be repentant. They want him to feel bad and get him. They want to get him to a place where he's willing to apologize for what he did to Brent and what he did to Elizabeth, and to commit to changing his ways. So they're going to threaten him, and then they're going to communicate with him over the walkie-talkie. So Elizabeth writes the note.
And Brent, in the meantime, has had some ideas of his own, and he has contacted, unbeknownst to Elizabeth, the police force in Riverside, where the original jurisdiction, where Mr. Treblinski had escaped and, you know, as far as the law was concerned, was on the lam. And he just asked some questions about the case, pretending to be a reporter, whether the case was still open, whether they had any leads or not. And his plan was that if things fell through, or if Mr. Treblinski didn't recant, or if he just for some reason needed to have this ace up his sleeve, he was going to call in the police force from Riverside, which wasn't too far away. So they gathered the materials, and they had done some Google earthing to figure out where there were some like bushes they could hide behind and trees they could hide in and so on around Mr. Dilby's property.
Kim Bellia was so excited about this part of the scheming. Yeah. She was so pumped to be back on the saddle.
And Mr. Dilby's house was easy to find. Perfectly manicured lawns, everything geometric, everything symmetric, paint, put new paint on it every couple years, just kind of the kind of house that made you feel uncomfortable because it was so well kept. It was too well kept. It kind of looked like an artificially AI generated real estate photo or something.
It made you feel bad for the lawn. Yeah. And they placed the note in an envelope with the walkie-talkie on the welcome mat. And then Elizabeth blared her tuba. And then they ran behind the bush and waited, and the door whipped open, and Dilby was there looking around, and then he saw the note on his welcome mat, and he picked it up. He pocketed the walkie-talkie, opened it, the envelope, and looked both sides of the paper, and he was mystified. And he picked up the walkie-talkie and spoke into it. Hello?
And he had all this breaker, breaker. Breaker, breaker, niner, niner. He was doing all this call sign, official CB type talk.
But nothing happened. And so he kind of looked around. He was kind of confused, and he sort of crumbled up the note and he mashed it up with the walkie-talkie, and he walked out to his trash can on the curb and just threw them both in the trash can, and then walked back into his house. And the three young adults hiding in the trees and bushes, hiding in the bushes nearby, saw this happen and kind of were crestfallen. They were dispirited. They were looking at each other with wide eyes, like, what do we do now? How do we do this? And they started to whisper in excited tones with each other about their next steps. Brent said, and, all right, let's go around back.
Said, gonna get you. Here we come. It's getting hot.
And Elizabeth said, what?
And then she repeated it. And Elizabeth was like, oh, yeah. And
Brent looked at them both and said, I don't understand. Is that a plan? Like, maybe, you know, we could just call the cops on him. Like, we could just call the cops. They're like, no.
Kimbrellia says, hey, I thought you didn't know how to play the tuba. to Elizabeth. I thought you just carried that thing around. And Elizabeth sheepishly said, well, yeah, I mean, I kind of learned, but I told you, I haven't played since Dilby tore me down that day. And Kimbelia said, no, hey, you know what? You are going to play that tuba. You're going to play that tuba.
And you're going
to... Deadeye is going to do its first show ever right here,
with
right
our
now.
With biggest goddamn fan. And she was pointing to the house. And Brent, who thought that he was the timid one, thought that he was not so sure, was like, hell yeah! And he jumped up and just started running towards the house. And they got caught up in the excitement. And they all went behind him. And he came up to the door and just threw it open. Mr. Dilby hadn't locked it. And ran into the foyer and started looking around for Mr. Dilby. Mr. Dilby, sitting in an easy chair facing the other direction with a corncob pipe and his feet up and sort of like reading a book about,
World War II.
Okay. And heard the commotion and turned around and Brent tackled him. Brent just ran up as he was spinning his chair around, and Brent just like full shoulder tackled them,
threw him into
the
ground,
the chair
and,
over
and started wrestling for his the back of his pants, and grabbed a belt loop and ripped the cord of his sliding glass door curtains and tied the curtain cord around Dilby's pants and just started heaving and lifted Dilby off the ground until he was
in flag corps, so he was actually quite athletic. And Mr. Dilby, for all of his bravado, was actually a pretty frail older man.
And at the same time, Kimbrella, who had found an outlet to plug in her electric guitar, which she had brought as part of a diversionary tactic, but it just so happened to come in handy, and she struck the first chord of Hotter, Hotter, Faster, Faster.
And the guitar sounded atrocious. It had not been tuned in 30 years. It didn't hardly work.
But if you thought that sounded bad, the tuba that came in next sounded even worse.
And Brent has lashed Dilby to a chair. Turned him around to face the band, which is standing in his living room playing Hotter, Hotter, Faster, Faster. Right in his face.
And in their minds, it's coming together great. They're actually, this is euphoric. It's their first show. It's amazing. The crowd's on fire. Everything's great. But Mr. Dilby is hearing it for what it is, which is just like pure noise and right in his face. And obviously, as a tuba player, he's taking personal offense at like how badly the tuba's being played. And this just goes on and on. And Mr. Dilby is also afraid for his life. He doesn't know what these psychotic children or younger people might have planned. So as the song is building in intensity, Mr. Dilby is panicking more and more and begins to breathe irregularly. Brent, just caught up in the bloodlust of it all, doesn't even notice this.
Brent has discovered that the other walkie-talkie will create a feedback thing when he presses the button. So he's coming in periodically with feedback, which like he thinks sounds awesome, like gives it a little bit of a techno vibe.
And everybody is so caught up in the moment that they don't realize that standing in the kitchen is
Mrs.
the ghost
Dilby.
Of Elizabeth's It's the ghost of Elizabeth's grandpa.
Right next to Mrs. Dilby.
Right next to, behind Mrs. Dilby. Mrs. Dilby has called the Tronville police. And they show up outside about the same time the Riverside police show up outside. The Riverside police got really suspicious after Brent's phone call and were looking into things, and they finally had a breakthrough. They pieced it together. They traced the call. They were looking into yearbook photos, and their detectives had pieced together that Dilby was Trabelsky, and they sent over their SWAT team. And Mrs. Dilby had called the Tronville police, who sent their SWAT team, and both SWAT teams arrived at the street at the same time and quickly got into a huge argument about whose jurisdiction this was. They're in Tronville, but this was a Riverside case, and they were going back and forth about the legal regulations about who had the right to get in there and rescue Dilby / Trabelsky.
Both departments were desperate for a big win. They'd received nothing but bad press for the previous year, and it was their chiefs, their respective chiefs, had just said, no matter what it takes, bring this guy in. But Trabelsky, for his part, is going into cardiac arrest now in the chair, and nobody is noticing. He's
except granddad, Elizabeth's grandfather,
who's behind Mrs. Dilby. And granddad is just saying, no, stop, trying to get Elizabeth's attention. Yeah. And Elizabeth is not to, her attention is not to be had.
And finally, so
they're playing through Elizabeth and Kim Belliar. The whole album comes back to them and they're just playing the album straight start to finish.
So granddad inhabits Mrs. Dilby's body and runs in her body to unplug the amp and scream in their faces, "He's dying, you have to do something." And Brent grabs Mrs. Dilby and Mrs. Dilby yells, "No, no, Buttercup, tell him to stop." And
Elizabeth recognizes that as her grandfather's pet name for her. And she says, "What? How did you get in there?" And he's like, "It was way harder than anything else before this. And I don't know how long I have, but he's having a..."
So no more questions.
"For God's sake." And then it stops and then she collapses to the floor. And it's clear that his possession has ended. And now, having broken the spell of the song, they can hear the commotion on the sidewalk. The SWAT teams have they've reached a temporary agreement that they're just going to get in there first and they'll figure out later who gets to take them in.
So Kimbellia freaks. Windows open. Kimbellia freaks because she knows that
she
this
actually
cannot
does
happen.
Have a record.
Yeah, and just takes out the back door and into the backyard. She just runs.
SWAT teams haven't covered the backyard very unprofessionally because they've been arguing so
well,
much. Because
the front door is where all the glory is.
That's the thing they're arguing about is they're keeping going, "Well, no, you guys go around the back."
So
they come in.
The lead agents from both teams kick down the door. One of them kicks down the door, and the other one gets to go in first. And then the first one goes right behind.
And as soon as they go in, they see Elizabeth. They see Elizabeth.
There's the kicker in the first entry.
Hitting this man on the chest, Mr. Trilby, on the chest, like in rhythmic, like time.
While Brent is giving mouth to mouth to an old lady on the floor.
and
he thinks
door
quickly and says,
open.
"Thank goodness you're here."
And Mr. Trilby comes back.
His name.
Mr. Dilby.
That's actually part of what the SWAT teams agreed to too. They were like, "No, it's Dilby. No, it's Trabelsky." And they're like, "Fine, we'll call him Trilby. We'll just leave it at that."
Whoever he was.
And the SWAT teams have been trained that when you go into a scene like that, you don't know who the criminal is. You have to assume that everyone is the criminal because they might be faking, they might be trying to trick you. So four agents go after all four of them.
And they just start handcuffing
them. Just because someone is tied to a chair doesn't mean that they're the victim.
And Dilby is back in himself enough to be like, "Officers, I'm not a criminal. These hoodlums broke
into
my house."
All those punches in the chest did the trick, right?
Yeah.
Got his ticker back
going.
Oh,
yeah. He's back. He's back up and he's angry. He's furious. And
he
Elizabeth
starts bossing
all
the agents around and they listen. They start taking orders from him.
They
right?
start taking orders. And Elizabeth's like, "No, you don't understand. He's Mr. Trabelsky. He's a criminal." And even the Riverside police are like, "Well, I don't know. There's not a lot here to go on." And he's like, "That's right. You won't find anything with my name on it here." And Elizabeth says, "Except that coffee cup." And she points at the coffee cup from Wendy's that's sitting on the counter. And one of the officers who's standing nearby, who is looking at it, kind of wanting to drink it, picks it up and says, "Mr. Dilby on here." And she says, no, squeeze some lemon juice on it.
And he does.
And they go
sure
to the kitchen,
enough,
cut up an 11.
And sure enough, the Trabelsky name with like a evil clown face kind of appears on the cup. And that's enough to raise the officer's suspicion, at least. And they know
that from an evidentiary standpoint, this really might not hold up in court. But they're so mystified by how this girl
Trilby said,
this
"I didn't write that," and you said, "Yeah, but you said nothing in here would have your name on it." And
so they start.
So how
searching
can we
it.
Trust
they,
you? They, we really know that we can't trust you. That's the only thing we know at this point.
They call it in and they get a warrant and they start searching his house and they take Brent and Elizabeth out front and they start questioning them separately. They're turning it into a crime scene. They're looking for stuff. And pretty soon they're able to find some stuff that connects back to
what
to
they Trilby. Find.
The paramedics show up. The paramedics show up to treat Mr. Dilby. I just wanted to share this important detail. And they're administering aid to him. And
he's like, "I'm fine. That kid, that boy punched me in the chest a few times."
They do put on plastic gloves, and Mr. Dilby is comforted greatly by their gloves.
He asks if he can have a pair, and they give him one.
Yeah. But and they also take a DNA sample from him at the time.
Well, that's what did him in, is that he... they got DNA. The janitor had saved all the gloves that still had his sweat because those things never dry out. And the janitor from the old school also did the same thing, and they compared the sweat, and it was the same man.
The jury only needed about an hour and a half to come back with a unanimous guilty verdict.
Most of that time was debating what to call him.
Brent and Elizabeth were sentenced to 6 months, although they were released after just a couple on good behavior and in exchange for their testimony against Mr. Dilby, which was
although
not-
and. Elizabeth Brent, was banned from playing any music for the rest of her life.
And Brent found peace and moved back to Riverside. He hadn't been back to Riverside since he left. He moved back and
started a flag school.
But it was really casual. It's really an easy going. He wanted to bring a new philosophy of flag management, where there just weren't a lot of rules. It was kind of a do what you feel sort of thing. Let's celebrate how fun flags are and really not worry about the details.
And Flag Day in Riverside was, within years, bar none, the best holiday. Everyone's favorite.
Elizabeth,
not just the flag people, not just the kids who went to the school, but like the whole town loved it.
Elizabeth was watching Flag Day and so proud of Brent and everything he'd made of himself. And as she was sitting sort of at the top of the bleachers, she felt a presence next to her and she turned and sure enough, Grandpa had appeared and they didn't say too much. They just kind of looked at each other lovingly. And she said, "I'm sorry, Grandpa, I never did get the tuba. I never did learn how to play, and now it's sort of a lost cause." And he said, he turned to her and he said, "That's all right. It's actually called the sousaphone."
And then somebody walked by or someone else was sitting on the bleachers watching Flag Day and left their coffee cup there. And Granddad said, "Buttercup, you're gonna," and then he blipped out.
and Elizabeth picked, he had pointed at the coffee cup before he disappeared, and she picked it up and she turned it around, and it was written on the other side. It just said lemon. And she looked at it and she thought, "That's kind of a weird name." And then she just was reflecting on it and thought, "You know, this is nuts, but I'm just gonna," and she walked to the concession stand and ordered a club soda with lemon slice. And she took the lemon slice and she squeezed it. She squeezed it on the other side of the cup. And sure enough, a message appeared and it said, "See you at the treehouse in an hour, K."
And that's the first practice of Dead Eyes reunion tour. Started that night. The end.
The end.
End.
Baderson stories are improvised and recorded live over the internet. We clean up the audio, but we don't edit, rehearse, or redo any content for better or worse. Subscribe and find other stuff we do at Baderson.com. And remember, when you tell a story, it's like you're graduating from college with a hardened criminal.